današnji kulturni kroniki nadaljujemo s tematizacijo romana Hiper kurdskega pisatelja Agrija Ismaila. Monetarne tokove smo prek različnih davčnih oaz ter centrov kapitala izsledile do njihovega vira. V nadaljevanju bomo namreč prisluhnile intervjuju z avtorjem.
You often describe your book as a narrative driven by capital that is Trojan horsed into the literary world by a family drama. Could you describe which reproductive sides of capital you encoded into each of the Hardy siblings?
Yeah, I mean, so my initial idea for the first draft was to actually do a tree of different decisions. I don't know if you have these books in Slovenia, the kind of choose your own adventure, where they're like, does the hero pick up the sword, turn to page 33? So I had a tree like that of different things happening to the characters, and they all had a share price. So, for instance, Siver had LVMH, Louis Vuitton, Moët Hennessy. And if the day that something was to happen, that price went up, this would happen. And if the price went down, something else would happen. That became, in the end, untenable because the bits were the different sections of the book which follow each sibling became very different in length and complexity. So the London part was like 450 pages. The New York part was 60. So I kind of had to sand a lot of that out, but I did want the decision-making to be run through the lens of capital. And then as humans, I mean, that's how at least I experience the world, is you move to a place because there's a job there. You know, there's so many decisions that we make which are linked to money. And yet as humans, we have this facility to kind of create narratives for ourselves that are not as crass as that. We think, oh, I needed a new challenge in my life. I needed this or that. And so the challenge for me when I made the first draft was when these decisions had all been made by a share price going up and down by the stock market, how do I then make the characters live through it as though these were conscious choices, or at least they imagined themselves to be conscious choices?
So, again, also in Threes, you stated that you tried to explore different centers of capitalism throughout history. So London in the 19th century, New York for the 20th, and Dubai for the 21st. What do you feel these centers of capital represent today? And maybe more importantly, how are they regulating opacity in relation to wealth and the underclasses each city is trying to make invisible?
Oh, that's a very good question. I mean, the interesting thing about a center of capital is, if we're talking in terms of centuries and not millennia, because of course a place like Baghdad was a center for capital a few thousand years ago. It was the first city that had 1 million inhabitants. And I think very few people think of it that way. But even though London has not been at the center for almost 200 years now, it still very much attempts to stay as a relevant force. There were, you know, all these attempts after around the time Margaret Thatcher was prime minister to kind of modernize the stock market to make it attractive to investors. And a lot of the rhetoric around Brexit was, in fact, that some people in the kind of Boris Johnson circles were stating that the city of London could be like Switzerland, you know, like a capital or investment-friendly hub. New York was the 20th century equivalent of that, you know, especially after World War II, really became the center. And I think it's still unclear what will be the center going forward for this century. I chose Dubai as kind of an example for the generic city. It could have been Singapore, it could have been Doha. You know, there's plenty of places which are very, very friendly towards investment, often tax havens of different sorts, but like playgrounds for the world's rich. And in charting these three cities, you do see how capitalism has evolved when you talk about opacity, because in London and New York, as cutthroat as those places are, and as hard as it is to live there, certainly anywhere near the center where it's been far too expensive for many, many years, you still have the right to live there if you are as someone with a legal residence. If you lose your job, there are certain parameters in place in the United Kingdom, far fewer in the United States, and in Dubai, none. And in Dubai, you're really seen as an employee of the private company, which is Dubai itself. And if you lose your job, you have 30 days to find a new one, or your residency is no longer valid. Or at least that was the case 10 years ago. I don't think it has changed, but your residency status is linked to your employment status. And that is something that we've seen has changed in the way that people kind of deal with it. In the UK, there has been such a strong, historically a strong labor movement that as much as it wanted, capital couldn't entirely erode it. New York has had less, and Dubai virtually has none. And I think that is an interesting progression in how capitalism can inhabit various cities around the world.
Throughout the novel, we can observe how the head of the family, Rafik, relentlessly tries to both pursue the revolutionary dream and share his knowledge with anyone around him, first his comrades and later his children. I find that his character very clearly articulates the struggles of Marxism in an age of more and more abstract finance, increasingly systemized exploitation, and unimaginable technologically mediated scales. At least to me, Rafik's comments and bits of wisdom that he shares never seemed wrong, but maybe just a bit outdated. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about the ability of Marxism as a theory to articulate the present?
Yeah, I mean, that was really one of the things that I wanted to kind of put in the book, because I would identify myself as a leftist. And how do you write from that perspective without making it a sense of propaganda? And the way I found was a lot through reading Doris Lessing's The Golden Notebook. I don't know if you've read that, but in which she takes on the kind of Anki era of communism. You know, once Stalin has done what he has done, how can we still be communists, etc.? And I just thought, what is the reality on the ground for leftists across the Western world? Well, we lost. I don't think there's any clearer way to describe it than whatever it was that was being fought for many, many decades. We have, by and large, lost the fight. And part of that is, from what you're saying, the kind of strict Marxist analysis tends to be co-opted by capitalism, by the way that it can... You know, Marx himself calls capitalism a vampire, like you can't kill it, it will always come back in a different form. And Marxism or leftism doesn't have that inherently built in, that vampiric element of reacting to the world around it. So maybe it was always on the back foot. But I did want to kind of share the broken heart of the leftist kind of movements, which find themselves, you know, there's plenty of people who are still espousing things that were said 50 years ago, but without truly believing that it can change the world anymore, or it's just like, this is wrong. These analyses are still valid, and capitalism is making all of our lives worse, but without actually believing that you could change the system within.
So both Hazal and Siver are in every point of their lives more or less directly acting and deciding in relation to two systems, capital and patriarchy on the other side. Even though the book is mostly set in a recent past, it articulates very well how archaic but powerful social structure like patriarchy permeates through generations. Silvia Federici articulates this in her theory as social reproduction being a sphere that goes hand in hand with reproduction of capital, the latter relying on the former as a stable and hard-coded social structure that can be used to exploit labor that it struggles to mechanize. Mm. How do you feel about this relation?
Yeah, I mean, it was a very conscious choice I made that Siver, the only daughter in the family, would have a much more precarious life than her brothers, because not only does she have the challenges that they have, but she's also a woman in, first of all, a patriarchal family, but then she chooses to move to Baghdad and then Dubai, which are both very patriarchal societies. And also with the father, Rafiq, as much as he espouses a certain sense of idealism, he still very much expects to be the patriarch in his own home. He still has that control over his family, even if he doesn't have any control over the world around him. So this is a dichotomy that can be solved if you have, you know, consciousness of it and you agree that it is an issue that warrants our attention. But a lot of time, one of the kind of recurring conversations I've had throughout my life is one of the more frustrating types of conversations is with kind of leftist white men who are like, oh yeah, but all that thing is irrelevant. Class is the only thing that's important. And it's like, yeah, but that's easy for you to say because you don't have all the other things, right? There is no racial or sexual or gender related power structures that in any way affect you. So yeah, it's easy for you to say that class is the one thing that matters. And in a small way, I kind of wanted to give credence to that idea that, yeah, she has, and Khajal as well. I mean, she could have been the mother, could have been, she's in many ways far more adept at navigating the world than her husband is. And yet she could never become a self-fulfilled person because she's restricted purely by the fact that she's a woman and that she's kind of self-internalized the role of a woman is supposed to play. She cannot break loose from it. She doesn't see it as something that's wrong inherently.
So the book's title is at least somewhat based on Baudrillard's concept of hyperreality that refers to his fourth stage of relations between images and reality, hyperreality becoming the point where the image becomes reality with no reference point outside itself and the representation collapses, right? So while reading the book, I also thought of the documentary Hyper Normalization, which articulates how the geopolitical reality was shaped by secret services and carefully constructed narratives. If I understand correctly, you're also writing a novel that focuses on technologies of control. Somebody once said to me that secret services control the world, not capital. So yeah. How do you feel about this relation?
I mean, it's super interesting because right now I'm very deeply into the kind of secret service research, and I have like the capital research is 10 years old at this point, over 10 years old. Yeah, I mean, I think the as abstract as capitalism is, and it is very, very abstract for most people, at least it's something tangible. The secret service element of it, the shadow world, is not visible to the vast majority of us at all. And there was a report, this was as late as, I think it was 2019, 2020, that there were far more documents being redacted every year than were being published in print. So the kind of the size of the shadow world is eclipsing our own. There are more things that are hidden than that are seen. And for a very long time, the only kind of positive of this was something that I think it was someone who worked at the Pentagon said, well, we have all of this information, you know, all the stuff that Snowden came out with, the massive, massive espionage of civilians and everything. We have all this information, but it would take a god to be able to see it all. Like, we cannot see the totality of what we've constructed here. But of course, now with AI, one of the things that it is very good at is to see the totality of something that for a human would be unfathomable, kind of graspable. So I think that is the kind of next step that I was very interested in trying to map out. What does this look like? You know, there are small things that are interesting that are like Google Maps, for instance, or any Google Earth or any of these services that have mapping services. A lot of times secret areas aren't visible there and they've just cloned pixels to kind of cover over the thing they don't want you to see. But of course, if you still go there, in person. If you're allowed near the site, you can see that there's a building where the map tells you there is none. There are plenty of, you know, artists who are doing a lot of interesting work. Trevor Paglen is one of them, about the kind of the invisible world. I think until fairly recently, it hasn't had the power to, in truth, rule the world. I think it was more concerned with not just observing, but mainly observing, because the things that it could act on were so limited in comparison to the vast amounts of observations taking place. Now, I don't know. It's entirely possible that it is ruled by an AI algorithm telling people, well, these guys are dangerous here. You know, Israel is using AI drone systems that are actively targeting people based on decisions not made by humans. So maybe an interesting thought experiment, at least. But yeah, capitalism, as abstract as it is still tangible. We can still point at it and say these are the effects of it, whereas this other stuff, by definition, isn't meant to be seen.
So you've often said that you're an after writer, in the sense that you write about something after it's happened, or that it's clear to you in its entirety. Mm. If we would compare the time your novel is set in regards to our current state, we could say that a lot of intensity was a bit more obscured back then, or hidden, in the sense that now everything is on the surface. The genocide, US invasion, state violence, everything is documented all the time. So I was wondering, how do you feel about this difference in exposure, and in the sense of how we're becoming desensitized by all these images?
Yeah, I mean, it's the murder of Renee Nicole Good last week in Minneapolis was indicative of this, because that was, you know, the ICE employees who shoot this woman in her car. And we have the murder from so many points of view, all of these filmed points of view. And a news organization like the New York Times can go through that and compare it with the government's response of, you know, the police or the ICE officer was feeling attacked and therefore he shot. And they're showing, well, the car didn't hit him, wasn't on his way to hitting him, etc. So what does it do to us that we have these many, many points of view filmed of the same event, compared to, while I was writing the book, there was the shooting in Baghdad that the private security organization Blackwater had an employee at Christmas that was walking home drunk and got into an altercation with a guard of the vice president at the time and shot him dead. And even then, the kind of response was, well, when he went, the guy who shot the guard went and found some people, he was like, well, I was being attacked. And there was no video confirmation of this. We still managed to find out what had actually happened, but it was in no way the same. And the government, the US government at the time, was very critical of what Blackwater had done. But of course, now, even with the filming of the murder of Renee Good, American citizen in America, the government can say, well, this was justified. And so things like, you know, the live streaming of a genocide in Gaza become even more abstracted, because you've got, they are the deemed the others. They're not even deemed a citizen of the country. So of course the US government can say, well, that's propaganda, or we don't really care about it. So it's become far more visible, but at the same time, the excuses and the waving away of what's happening have become far more brazen. And I think it's easy to feel a little bit crazy when observed reality isn't matched by what the official responses are to that observed reality. I think everyone feels a little bit crazy at the moment.
One of the things I was wondering about that I haven't seen discussed about your novel is also that I feel like each of the three siblings articulates their own political position or ideology in a very interesting way. For example, Siver is this very progressive person that still gets tangled in old patriarchic structures, then on the other side, Muhammad or M being this person who sells their heart to success and capital, you know, very libertarian in a sense. And then Laika, on the other hand, being this terminally online person that has like a certain distance. I think you also use the term necropolitics in discussing this. So how do you feel these three positions apply to our understanding of capitalism, and how do you think they have been updated now?
Yeah, I mean, so Muhammad is able to get a job in finance in London, even though he doesn't have the background that you're supposed to have. And the UK being a very class-centric society, where it's very clear, you know, what kind of schools you've gone to, what kind of home and upbringing you've had. The finance sector at the time was still one where you could get in if you were just able enough to hustle your way through it, which created a kind of flattening and allows for certain people to still believe in a form of meritocracy, right? There's not that many industries where that illusion can even be upheld anymore, because you will see it as soon as you try to get in that, oh yeah, no, like, these universities in the US that are supposed to be the world's best, they're filled with idiots whose, you know, parents have gone there, and so their legacy, or their parents are wealthy enough to donate a computer lab, and it's in no way a meritocracy. But the finance sector, at least at the time in London, did allow for this type of mindset to exist, because you were able to get in. I think for someone like Muhammad, it would be even harder now to do so. I mean, even at the time, there was a tendency to kind of offload the non-white projects on the non-white finance people. So he gets to do the hotel in Mecca, he gets to do the Islamic finance project, etc. But even that stuff has now been taken up by the majority society. Like, they don't see that as a weird offshoot anymore. Something like Islamic finance is really well established at this point, and he wouldn't be needed for that purpose. Whether or not his outlook would have changed, perhaps he might not be as libertarian when he doesn't have the ability to believe in a meritocracy, but he'd probably be just more bitter and disaffected. I don't see him as a politically kind of awakened person. And I think he would have a hard time to kind of articulate anything other than bitterness. Siva, unclear. Like, you say that, you know, that she's progressive, which she absolutely is, because she grew up in a time in the UK where that level of progressivism was very mainstream, you know, like Time magazine, you know, having the Spice Girls on as some kind of like feminist icons, and at least we pretended to care about things like equality and peace on earth and all these things that now seem very kind of idealistic, but at the time at least we pretended to care about them. And so she's very much a product of that generation. I think if she'd grown up only 15 years later, I think then I have a friend who studies kind of youth culture amongst people who are young now, and there doesn't seem to be much in the way of idealism anymore. It's more like, I need to have a sense of security, and I get to worry about, you know, the state of the world or questions of fairness later. So maybe more in that way. And Laika would absolutely be a alt-right. Like, he's too steeped in the online milieu to not be influenced by the flip of Twitter to become X, and the kind of meme culture becoming ultra-right wing and so on. So I think he would be the one that has the most different politics, because he is a creation of the internet, and the internet has changed quite a bit in the last 15 years.
S tem se poslavljamo od avtorja in za danes zapiramo platnice dela Hiper. Če kapitalizem pogosto deluje kot nejasen in vse prisoten, ne moremo trditi, da se literatura tu ponuja kot rešiteljica. Vseeno pa ustvarja prostor, v katerem se lahko nasprotja, neskladnosti in napetosti artikulirajo ter natančno popišejo realnost delovanja kapitala zadnjih nekaj desetletij. Opozarja nas, da nobena družbena struktura nikoli ni statična in da bomo kaj kmalu potrebovali nov presežnik. Hiperštručko je jedla Leja. V podlagi sta bila uporabljena komada Royalty, produced by Noir in Alone with my thoughts, avtorice Baby Ghost.
Nič se ne dogaja, nobenih eventov, nobenih jobov ni, tema skratka, to je to.
Poslušali ste Kulturni obzornik.